Wait a second. This isn't your grandma's cancer show.
Not your grandma's cancer show.
Hi, I'm Tatum Duroc, and today we're talking about reconnecting with our bodies. One thing that can happen is we can feel a bit like our bodies become this alien landscape after a cancer diagnosis, which can make everything feel harder, both physically and emotionally. On top of that, we're often seeing so many pictures of active cancer patients on top of mountains, and it can feel like it's just happening to us, that it's so hard to feel in our bodies, to want to do anything with them, to trust that they will be there for us in the way that they were before. I want to tell you that you're not alone with feeling this disconnect. Today, we're looking into some of the science and research, because you're definitely not alone with this. So we've got a great guest, Claudia Knowles from King's College. She's a research assistant and she's also training to be a psychologist. And we're going to do something a bit different at the end of this podcast today. We're going to do a little breath work and some relaxation. So get comfortable and welcome Claudia, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Tatum. Thank you for having me on.
So tell me about this project that you're doing at King's College.
There are two different main projects that I'm working on, but both focused on the sort of mind-body connection, and both focused on sort of wanting to develop interventions that support people who've had a cancer diagnosis. So the first one is around body mindset. So our attitudes towards our body are the sort of lenses through which we view our body and ourselves. And what you were just saying in your intro was also, I was like, oh, ding, ding, ding. There's so many different things which were so relevant to what I'm going to speak about. And one of those is the idea that, you know, during cancer, you might feel that your body's turned against you. You might feel that you've lost trust in your body. And so through this particular project, what we're doing, we're working with young adult cancer survivors. And we've developed a sort of video-based intervention to help people think about what are these different mindsets I could hold about my body? What am I holding about my body? And how can I try and foster a more helpful mindset? So that might be the idea that actually, no, I do trust my body and it is trustworthy. It's working with me rather than the idea that it's turned against you. And then the other project is around interoception. And this is kind of become a bit of a buzzword as well in sort of academia. It's really exciting. It's quite recent. A lot of the studies around this sort of unconscious processing side of interoception. I'm going to explain it. Yeah.
So I was like, I think I know most of my, you know, proprioception and other
receptions. Yeah, you're on top of your receptions.
Yeah, but this was something a bit new for me.
Yeah, and it also is very intuitive once you start to think about it. So interoception essentially refers to our sensing, our processing, our understanding of our internal bodily signals. So exteroception, external, that's the sort of opposite. So things that you're feeling. So if you scratch your arm or if you, touch something that's hot. Interoception is the constant dialogue between our internal bodily states, our organs, our everything that's going on in our body and our brain.
So would that be something like, oh, I can feel my tummy rumbling?
Exactly. Yep. Hunger is you intercepting, essentially, that your tummy is telling your brain, like, oh, I'm empty, need some food. And you're sensing that. But what's really interesting and where our research is looking and a lot of the recent research is looking is how that's connected to emotion and how bodily signals elicit emotions. So we know that already that sort of emotions can change how things feel in your body. So if you're stressed, your heart rate might rise, your breathing might shorten, you might start sweating. But there's also this flip side where actually what's starting with the body that's then triggering an emotion. So that might be similar things. It might be the heart rate rising, the brain going like, oh, heart rate's rised. Mm. What's going on here? Let's draw attention to this. When actually there might be nothing going on, but your brain is going like, let's make this consciously aware. And then we assign some kind of anxiety to it, and we think something might be wrong. We then focus on it, we get worried, that then increases the heart rate, and then you get this kind of cycle of anxiety going round and round, where you're catastrophizing and worrying, and that's having an impact again on your bodily sensations. But then all of that might have just been triggered by a slight misinterpretation of a bodily signal, which otherwise would have been sort of in the distance somewhere.
I feel like I've been there so many times.
Yeah.
So many times. So I've had so many different types of hot flushes. Someday I will collate all the different ones. But there seems to be one particular kind of hot flush where it's just this feeling of everything being wrong with the world, and it's just doom, and nothing's okay, and no one's okay. And as, you know, that feeling peaks, then the sweat comes out, and you go, oh, I'm having a hot flush. It isn't the end of the world.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just a hot flush. Like, that was a whole emotional roller coaster ride that went with it. And when you're dealing with that, and there might also be waiting for a scan at the same time, when that peaks, then it's hitting the reality of what's in your brain, which is worry. And then it does seem like those flushes get worse and worse and worse. Would that be a cycle that would come underneath that kind of...
Yeah, I think that's a really good example, because also, especially after cancer or sort of during cancer, there are so many real concerns and worries and things that might trigger those type of fears and anxieties. And when things are being made consciously aware by our brain, so most of our internal signals are kept quiet to our sort of conscious brain, because if we're listening to all of them, it'd be completely overwhelming, like all of our organs moving around and all of these different heartbeats and like breathing and cell movement and cell division, whatever. The brain needs to silence most of it so that we can just get on with our day.
Mm-hmm.
And what it tends to do is make predictions about things in life, about how our body's working, about how the external world is working, so that it can be efficient and not have to make these sort of conscious hard decisions all the time. But sometimes those predictions can be go slightly askew or be slightly unhelpful. And that might be in something where it's predicting that, for example, whenever you have a hot flush, that something bad is happening. And I think, like you say, that combination of the physical sensation with the emotion is, and then you realize after, like, oh, actually that was a hot flush coming through me. But the initial feeling for you is stress and worry and concern and anxiety. And I think we also, it's sort of helpful to think about it in terms of our brains want to make sense of things. We want to put a narrative to something. So if we think there's something wrong, like with a hot flush or with our heart rate rising, we want to kind of put a story to it so we can understand it. And if we've already got those fears and concerns floating around somewhere in our head about fear of recurrence or fear about a scan coming up, then those might get attached to that bodily signal. And with interoception, it's really interesting because we split it into sort of two different sides. There's one side which is interoceptive accuracy, and that's your ability to accurately sense your physical bodily sensations. So how much am I able to accurately sense how many times my heart is beating in 30 seconds? And that is very different to what we think and feel and believe about our perception of our body, so our interoceptive sensibility.
So that sounds like a really practical thing. Like, it's a concrete, measurable thing to be able to tap into. But also, I couldn't even imagine knowing what my heart is doing.
Yeah, exactly. So the main study that we're basing our work on is this incredible study that came out of Sussex University. There's a professor called Sarah Garfinkel, who's now at UCL, and someone called Dr. Lisa Quad as well, who's working on this. And what they were initially looking at were people who have autism and experience sort of heightened anxiety. And they developed this interoceptive training, which is purely focused on that kind of bottom-up training of your interoceptive accuracy. So I talk about bottom-up, that's in terms of sort of the unconscious processing side of it. There's also the top-down side of it, where you're consciously trying to lower your heart rate, for example, through breath work, through movement, that kind of thing. But what they were looking at is, okay, how can we adjust the fundamentals of what our brain is doing? And what other studies have found is that the higher someone feels something like anxiety, the less accurate they tend to be at detecting their bodily sensations like heart rate, but also the higher they tend to report having a sort of awareness of their body. So they might have this heightened sort of hypervigilance about their body, so constantly scanning or monitoring their body, which you can imagine if you're coming up to a scan in particular, and the anxiety that that might cause. That can often be inaccurate or cause really normal bodily sensations, which would normally be dampened, body's not listening to them, to be heightened. So you're like, oh, I feel this, or I feel this. There might be new sensations and you're genuinely feeling them, but only because your brain is making you aware of them, whereas normally you wouldn't be aware of them.
Oh, wow. That is fascinating, because I'm sure a lot of people have felt, I know I have, felt insane at times because... Yeah, you are kind of alive to these sensations in your body, and they're very strange, and your vigilance, your and wanting to tune in, but you're actually tuning into the cacophony of noise. So I would imagine pain is even higher in there, and lots of other sensations or nausea, or everything would be higher and more intense.
Yeah, and that's exactly like you say, those things are just heightened. And I think what's really important and reassuring for people to know is that it's not that their brain is making these things up. Those things are there. It's just that they're being brought attention to. And you're then less able to see, okay, what's just a normal, regular signal? So our heart rate, for example, fluctuates massively throughout the day. And there are times when we know it will fluctuate. So if you're walking really quickly or climbing up the stairs, it's going to increase. When you're sleeping, it's going to generally decrease. But there's also lots of other times where it might change. If you've had caffeine, if you haven't slept well, if you've eaten, all these different things that will impact your heart rate. And so it's always changing, and normal fluctuations in heart rate are totally, totally normal. But what can happen is when someone's feeling highly anxious and they're misinterpreting these signals, they might interpret a peak in one of those high heart rates, or just a sort of their attention being drawn to it, as a trigger for that anxiety, for example. So, and you can think about this sort of evolutionarily. It makes sense. This is actually like was a helpful thing to have. And Sarah Garfinkel, who I'm mentioning again just because she's the queen of interoception, and she's got a million podcasts that I can refer you to, but she talks about how say you were running away from a lion. When you start running, your heart rate rises. And in that situation, it makes total sense for your brain to recognize the high heart rate, to prioritize fear, and to get you to run faster. And in the meantime, to dampen your kind of peripheral signals around pain, actually might be one of them, but also a slight disconnection from your body.
Yeah.
Because if you're injured, or if you're running across sharp stones, whatever it is, you need that to not bother you in that moment. You just need to be running away from the lion. There's an element of where this is, you know, this can be helpful in certain situations. But then it can also get, like with everything in the modern day, mixed up and become less helpful in some settings. Yeah.
And I think that is a really nice reframing, that even when your body does seem to be going a bit bonkers and, you know, in producing these anxious signals that are not necessarily needed in that moment, that actually that is your nervous system doing its very, very best for you. And, you know, the more I'm feeling that, the more understanding I need to give my body. Like, that's actually the time to be like, oh, it's doing its best, and what can I do to help it? But when you were talking about the running away from the lion, what I could hear was when you're in a, you know, really scary situation, you hear your heartbeat in your ears, don't you?
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that when you were talking about that flip, that being able to tune into certain things. And actually, when we're terrified, we do hear our heartbeat.
That's a really good point, actually. And going back to what you were asking about, you know, how can interoception or interoceptive training kind of help us with this? So the training that they developed was essentially what you do is you go in for six sessions once a week. You have your finger hooked up to a pulse oximeter, so it's just measuring your heart rate. And you're asked to count your heart rate, how many times your heart beats within 20 seconds. And then there's another one which is about sort of delayed sounds, so it will play back your heartbeat either at the right sort of level, or it'll be slightly delayed to what your actual heartbeat is, and you just have to say if it's sort of on beat or off beat. And it's actually quite hard to do. And like you say, like, oh, imagining how much my heart is beating, I can't really, do I feel it? I don't know. And so you can start off by doing things like sort of raising your heart rate by doing star jumps or kind of chair-based poses or whatever you're able to do. And then that's actually easier to sense it because you're actually feeling it as well. And then over time, it becomes intuitive. And the way someone described it to me is when I was testing it out, it's like, I was like, oh, am I going to be able to feel it? And they said, just almost guess, like just guess what it is. And there's a part of your brain that is sensing it. And so that's what you'll be kind of bringing up. What they found is through this training, through this feedback, so they'd be telling people, yes, you were accurate, or, oh, you said 23 and actually it was 18. Just through that practice, and also through talking about that kind of normalization of heart rate changes and that sort of psychoeducation around like what's actually happening in your body. People's anxiety generally, I think a third of people in the group, their anxiety dropped to below any kind of diagnostic level. And even after a year, that had been maintained.
Wow.
So that's pretty incredible changes. And that's through training the sort of unconscious brain in a way to be better at detecting your heart rate. Because if you're better at doing that, then firstly, you'll notice what's more normal, but also you might notice more quickly when things are changing. So if your heart rate is rising, you might then be able to step in more quickly, do some breathing, bring it down, not get to the point where you don't actually realise that your body is panicking and you're having a panic attack, and then it's kind of got a bit too late to be able to step in to help out. So there's lots of different ways in which it can help, both in terms of just the general day-to-day, in terms of not misinterpreting those signals, but also when things are being made consciously aware, how you then deal with them and how you're able to deal with that.
My brain is whirring thinking about that, because when we are running away from a lion, for example, we cannot tune in. Every part of our body, every signal, every steroid, every hormone being released is sort of saying, don't tune in, get away and survive. And so by turning our attention inwards is like saying, well, perhaps there isn't a lion behind us, perhaps we're okay in this moment. Because that's completely the opposite of what you would do if you're unsafe. I can see how it would be deeply reassuring.
Yeah, and I think sort of bringing it back to sort of cancer experiences as well, something you'd asked me before when we spoke last time was around you know, that disconnect, like why does you feel that disconnection sort of during cancer or during treatment, and thinking as well about it from a sort of protective standpoint. If you've just been given a sort of life-threatening diagnosis, you're then put on this track, this treadmill of treatment, and your body goes into protective mode, and you are just racing towards that end point of, you know, when your active treatment finishes, when they say there's no evidence of disease. And then at that point, so you're kind of racing up the hill, and also at that point, you're handing over your body to the medical community, giving them full trust to do all the incredible things in terms of medicine that they're trained to do. And then you reach the top of that mountain, having been like supported all the way up there, and you're still running. And then at the end is just this cliff edge, and you stop and you have to climb down that cliff edge by yourself. And there's no guide and there's no guidance on how to do that. And that's the point that I see sort of once treatment ends, once active treatment ends, how people can feel about that huge abyss that looks forward, and knowing that at the bottom of that cliff as well, there is a new pathway, which isn't the one that you were taking before. It's a new one that you have to establish for yourself. And that can be extremely overwhelming. And it also means that that's the time where you've got the actual space to reflect and for your body to slow things down and think like, oh, actually, yeah, what's just happened? Start processing the enormity of that diagnosis, of that treatment. Recognize that, oh yeah, I've got this body that's changed now, and I've changed, and how do I reckon with this? How do I deal with this relationship? And some of the work we're doing around body mindsets is around thinking, okay, so this has happened, there's nothing, we can't change it, and it was terrible, and we don't want it to have happened. But how can we maybe look through a lens that says, okay, well, this is an opportunity for me to consider my relationship with my body and to consider how I want to learn from this and take that forward. So not trying to think about it in terms of like pure positive psychology and sort of airbrush what's happened or, you know, get rid of negative emotion, but to think, okay, how can I learn from this enormous change and thing that's rocked my whole world to rebuild that approach to life or to rebuild my life or to think about how my cancer slots into my life and like what my narrative looks like now. But yeah, there's so much about the body, I think, that's related to that.
You took us up and down a mountain there, and every stage of that mountain, you know, how someone, were they really sick before they were diagnosed? Mm. Were they misdiagnosed at the beginning? Did they have to wait a long time? Mm. Were they told in a dismissive way or not very kindly, or were there unnecessary procedures?
Yeah.
You know, if they're facing ongoing treatment and not quite sure, is there a top or is there a plateau where like that, actually all of that, if you think of your body running with your, you know, that pounding of your heartbeat in your ears for that suspended period of time. And you talked about kind of, you know, kind of giving your body over to the process. There is a, you know, a submitting that can happen to just get through, which is just as much of a survival as the running. But when you get to a point of safety, your body is going to continue to go, yeah, but are you sure?
Yeah.
It's going to continue to flare up to have those responses because it's trying to make sure, probably, are you really okay right now, this second?
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, just then and also at the beginning, like rebuilding that trust, regaining that trust in your body. In our body mindset intervention, we talk about, you know, what are the small things that you can do to prove to yourself that your body is working with you.
Mm.
And we've worked with some amazing people who've had experiences of childhood cancer who are part of the videos that we're developing. And they talk about, you know, the moment from, so one person couldn't move their arm at all. It was sort of, they couldn't move it more than 90 degrees. And each day they started being able to move it a little bit further, a little bit further, and just using those moments as proof that, like, oh yeah, my body can do this. There are these huge limitations now imposed on my body, but despite these, my body is working with me. I'm able to push my limits. I'm able to understand what I'm capable of and what I maybe need to wait to do a little bit. But recognizing that their body is still capable, and that even despite having had cancer and faced that really grueling treatment, their body went through that and got them through it, and being thankful for that and recognizing the sort of power of that body, even though it's been through so much. But absolutely, yeah, that sort of trust around worrying, like, what, is something going to come back? This has happened before, and it just makes it a realistic possibility in a way that it wasn't before.
Absolutely.
Or for someone who hasn't had cancer, that, you know, it's quite hard to imagine until you actually experience it.
Yeah, there's a great book by a man called Matthew Walker. It's not about cancer, but it is about healing. It's called Waking. And he was in a horrendous car accident when he was 14 and was paralyzed, I think, from the chest down. He was never going to be able to walk. He, you know, was told, basically, you're a young man, like, focus on the rest of your body, sort of. And he was like, but I think I feel something in my legs. And they were like, no, you don't. It's impossible. You know, focus on your arms, be strong. You know, there are sports that you can do and everything else. And he actually found his way into a yoga class when he was in his 20s and worked with someone who gave him the opportunity to actually be with his entire body, to feel it as he felt it. And he's now a fabulous yoga teacher.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And how he describes the body is as being endlessly devoted to you. So although it gets things wrong, you know. It
has good intentions.
It has good intentions. And sometimes there are little things that we can do to kind of help guide our body in the right direction.
Yeah.
But I think that really deep understanding that even sometimes when it's freaking out, that's part of its devotion.
Mm. That is an amazing story, because it is, like you say, it's focusing on that person's own lived experience. And that's what's so important in recovery and in care in general. And what can often get lost when you're working with statistics or sort of clinical generalizations. And my work when I was training as a counseling psychologist and training in sort of existential psychotherapy, and that's really rooted in the idea that we cannot separate our experience from our experience within our body, and we can't separate that experience from our experience with the world. These things are just intrinsically connected, and our social experiences, what we get through connection with other people, which we know how important that is also inherently rooted in the body as well, both from a sort of physiological level and also a kind of psychological level. So when we look at someone who's sad, we feel sad. Our neurons mirror the other person's neurons. When we see someone who's sad, their pupils tend to be smaller and our pupils will go smaller, and we actually physically mirror this emotion. But also, so there's an amazing professor of philosophy at Bristol called Javi Carell, who writes about the phenomenology of illness. So that's the lived experience, the subjective lived experience of illness, and how that's rooted in the body, and how illness changes your experience of your body and therefore your experience with the world, because of the way it allows you to engage with the world, because of how your identity is rooted in your body. And so not forgetting that your experience of your body and how important that is, and whether, you know, clinically someone might say, oh, but you're just not able to feel your toes, like you're paralyzed from the chest down, it's just not clinically possible. But that's that person's experience, and your experience is inherently rooted in your body. So being able to connect those things, like giving that person that space to be able to be with his body and feel his body and learn from it, is so important. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe there's something about that tuning in, even if, you know, kind of tuning into our heart rate, even though it might not feel all the time that accessible, that actually the process of doing it, the process of the permission, as being, so calming and kind of reintegrating.
Yeah.
One of the just odd body facts that I do love, an odd body fact, is that when we blush, so does the inside of our stomach lining.
That's a great fact.
Yeah. Yeah. You think, that's an emotional, that goes right into the body immediately, that then, same with butterflies. Sometimes we get butterflies before we've actually even looked at someone properly. We just have that buzzy feeling, and then we look and go, oh, are you cute? So our experience of the world is inside of our bodies.
Yeah.
And so if someone's listening to this right now and they're feeling almost like they might not even want to go back in there. There's been so much pain. There's been so much sense of like, why aren't you doing the right thing? What are some of the things from the research you've seen that have really worked for people in taking that first kind of gentle step into reconnecting?
Yeah, well, the first thing that comes to mind is a book by Bessel van der Kolk called The Body Keeps the Score, which I'd really recommend reading. And he worked with a lot of trauma, people who'd experienced severe trauma, firstly in the Vietnam War, and then also people who'd experienced sexual violence and abuse. And he went through this exploration of having been, I think, a psychiatrist working purely sort of in the 80s with drugs, which was kind of the main thing. Like, it's all about the brain. Emotional states can be reduced to mapped onto parts of the brain, and drugs will fix those things. And then broke away from that and thought, actually, no, we need to think about how this is so rooted in the body. And he went on this amazing kind of exploration and understanding of all these different ways in different cultures and different approaches that people deal with trauma. And one of those is around it's around yoga, it's around like working with the body. And he talks about how with PTSD, it can be really impossible to start something like talking therapy because the person is so disconnected from their body and dissociated from their body that they can't access things like emotions. And Gabor Mate talks about this as well. Emotional disconnection starts with bodily disconnection. And so what he ended up doing was developing a really safe way for people to come into their bodies before a session. So it might be kind of moving their arms, it might be doing breath work. They developed a sort of really safe way of doing yoga that wasn't re-traumatizing, especially for people who'd experienced sexual abuse. And so just coming into the body in a slow and safe way with someone who understands how that might impact you, and because it can be very, very emotional, and you might not realize the emotion that's being released if you're moving your body in a certain way. The interoceptive training is really interesting because it isn't asking people about their emotion, really. So it's not asking them to delve into their anxiety or what happened at all. It's just working with that heartbeat sensation. And that in and of itself might be worrying for people, but they found in the previous trials that they've done, generally people feel quite safe doing that. And it's not asking you to go deep into your emotional experience, but it has this huge emotional impact on the outside of it. So I think this is actually a really interesting area where we could be providing something that feels more accessible, more safe for people to start with, rather than going sort of straight into something that might feel a bit more intense or intimate as well.
Yeah. I mean, I'm all about gentle ease into things, and especially many people will have experienced medical trauma as well as kind of the shock and everything else that can come with a cancer diagnosis. Mm. Like, there can be a real, you know, kind of vibration of the nervous system really ringing. So you sort of mentioned at the end of there that, you know, kind of this is an area. Are there any other studies coming up? Anything that we should be keeping an eye on?
Yes. So, well, particularly our work. I'm just going to plug our work.
Yeah.
So firstly, what we're doing is we want to understand how people feel, so their interoceptive sensibility, how they kind of perceive their bodily sensations and their connection with their bodily sensations, and how that connects to anxiety or quality of life after and during breast cancer. So this has never been looked at in people who've had a cancer diagnosis. So while we can make assumptions and kind of hypothesize, we don't actually know what those connections are. But we do know, obviously, that things like anxiety and that sort of psychological distress, it can be really heightened after a diagnosis. So we have a survey which is just being launched at the moment, which we want as many people to do as possible. So it's for people who've had either a primary or secondary diagnosis of breast cancer who are living in the UK, and hopefully I can give you the link to put in. That'd
absolutely
be great. That'd be brilliant. And then also we're about to start recruiting for the Embody study, which is the body mindset intervention. So that's for young adults who've finished cancer treatment, so 16 to 25 year olds, and that will be testing this digital intervention that we've developed. I think also other sort of areas, so what we're hoping to do, where we're applying for funding at the moment, is to really expand on this interoception work around cancer. So what we hope to do is develop our own training for starting off for women who have breast cancer, but then also looking at other types of cancers, really trying to understand some of those interoceptive mechanisms, using things like MRI scans to really sort of see how is the brain changing around this kind of thing as well. Sarah Garfinkel at UCL, who I mentioned before, is doing some research on mindfulness in terms of interoception, because mindfulness is so interesting because it helps so many people, but not everyone. And some people doesn't help them at all. Some people it can make things worse. Some people can be absolutely fantastic. And what they're looking at is sort of, are there underlying interoceptive mechanisms? So like how people sense their bodily states that might influence the effectiveness of something like mindfulness. And then Lisa Quad, who's at Sussex, who also ran the original study around autism and anxiety, is constantly doing some interesting work. Interoception in general, there's a lot of they're looking at lots of different areas, so how it might relate to things like obesity, for example, or how it might relate to PTSD and trauma, and how people feel in their bodies after sexual trauma. And there's such a range of things that it will probably be sort of related to, and I think there's just a sort of surgence of research now kind of looking into all of those things. But I think for us, like the sort of from my work separately with people who've had breast cancer and sort of the support services that I've run, I think one of the biggest opportunities here is around empowering people after that point where they might feel really disempowered, having just finished active cancer treatment, feeling very out of control, having handed their body over to the professional community, and then being handed that responsibility back without a map or guide.
Yeah.
So what things can we give people, what tools can we give people to help them reconnect with their body and also reconnect with the world, with others, with the environment, with things that they want to do and things outside of their body as well.
Well, I love that this is being looked at, because I think, you know, it's been the experience of people for so long. And to know that, you know, kind of science is on the case, right? There's researchers that want to come to the rescue of this, that you're not being left high and dry, because I think that's been the case for such a long time. You talked about bottom-up interoception, but top-down interoception is things like what we can do to send signals to our body that we're safe. Is that correct?
Yeah, or things like where you're actively changing your bodily signals. So heart rate is a really obvious one, or shallow breathing might be one that you realize, like, oh, I have control over this. I can actually, I have the power to lower my heart rate. I have the power to deepen my breathing. And just that knowledge in and of itself is very empowering, especially because when you start to notice how it makes you feel once you do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there's a really cool set of resources. It's actually for like primary carers of children. Someone called Kelly Mailer has developed them. And they're to build interoceptive awareness and kind of accuracy in children, but I think they're really relevant for everyone. And I started thinking about them myself. And what they go through is thinking about like different parts of the body and different parts, like when in your day is it an opportunity for you to reflect kind of interoceptively? So when I hug someone, what's my heart doing? Do I notice my heart changing? Do I notice it sort of calming down? And especially that social connection, you do tend to see that. When I climb the stairs, what's happening to my heart? When I'm like going to sleep, what's happening to my heart? So what are these different parts of just your everyday where there can be a little kind of reminder to be like, oh yeah, what is my heart doing? And those moments can help you normalize those changes, because then you realize, wow, yes, it changes so much throughout the day. And it's because it's constantly responding to our environment. It's working really, really hard all the time. And normally we're not aware of how hard it's working. So just recognizing those changes firstly allows you to realize how hard it's working, but also then de-threatens those moments when you feel like, oh, is it going out of control? Is it rising too much? Is there a reason behind that? Is there something wrong?
I always imagine the heart as a bit of a nosy neighbor of the lungs. So I always think about that. Like if I do feel my heart racing, that it's got its ear up against my lungs. So my lungs are like the quickest way to tell my heart that actually everything's okay.
Yeah, I love that. Almost like it's hugging it and being like, just go slow.
Yeah.
That's
so
great.
Speaking of time of the day, I think it is time in this podcast, if you would like, would you like to stay for a little relaxation at the end of this?
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, I think that's a lovely idea.
So we're going to do this together. So what I would say is, let's have a little move. See if you're comfortable, because what can happen when we're listening sometimes is we end up in these positions that actually our body have wanted to move for the last few minutes and haven't. So giving yourself like just a little bit of a wiggle or a stretch, or giving a rub to any part of your body, your hands, your arms,
getting some
your
good
legs.
Clicks in my shoulders.
Yeah. And then just coming to a comfortable seat, or if you're lying down, by all means lie down. And then just close your eyes. Notice what your breath is already doing. Just after a couple of moments of moving, the exhale can sometimes just get a little bit longer all by itself. And if you're someone that likes to hold a picture in your mind, just thinking about your lungs, if they were unfurled and uncurled, they're actually the size of a tennis court. So as you're breathing in, just imagining just a little bit more of an expanse. Imagining that space that's inside you. And then if you like, and if it feels good, place your hands onto the lower side of your stomach. And with your next few breaths, just see how it feels to let the breath move all the way down towards your hands, fill up your stomach with air, and then gently release the air, letting your belly button move in the direction of your spine. So as you breathe in, you're breathing down into your hands. And as you breathe out, your shoulders are dropping down and away from your ears. And then becoming aware of the sides of your rib cage. And with your next breath in, imagining them moving out to where your arms are, to accommodate that airflow coming in. And then as the air comes out, they return back to their regular position. And they don't actually have to move. You can just hold a picture or hold space in your mind for the ribs gently coming out to the side to allow for that expanse, for that tennis court to fill up, and then slowly, slowly letting the air out. Then becoming aware of your back, your upper back. Can you breathe into it? Can your back expand? And then can you let all the air go? And then we're going to breathe in three different directions if it feels good for you. Going to breathe down into the lower part of your abdomen, out into the sides of your rib cage, and into your back, all at the same time. And then open your mouth and just let all that air out. And doing two more of those. Breathing down. Breathing out to the sides. Across your back. Filling up totally with air. And then letting it all go. As you exhale, your shoulders drop, your jaw relaxes. One last one of these. And then just letting your breath do whatever it wants to do. Imagining the space between your eyebrows being smoothed out. Your temples softening. The tip of your tongue, just placing it between your top teeth and your bottom teeth. Letting the jaw open. even imagining your ears relaxing. And then just becoming aware again of your breath and what it was doing when we took our focus off it. Thinking about that endless devotion that it has, that those tennis courts have for you. And if all the vessels in our lungs were all put beside each other, they would actually travel from here to Moscow. So acknowledging this space, perhaps becoming aware of your heart, imagining these long, slow, deep breaths, reassuring your heart. And just seeing if you can feel that response from your heart. Maybe it's there, maybe it isn't. But just knowing that the tuning in, the listening out for it, can let your body know that right now you are safe. Imagine any tension in your feet releasing into the floor or into the support underneath you. Imagining your hips just getting a little bit heavier. Your back having less responsibility to hold you up. Your hands softening. The back of your head, the sides of your head, the top, your forehead. Being surrounded in a sense of calm. And taking one more deep breath in. And if you like, give a slight pause at the top of the inhale. And then let it go and make some noise. You can rub your hands together and place your hands over your eyes. And just by placing them there, sometimes a nice exhale comes out all by itself. Gently open your eyes behind your hands. Then open your fingers to let in a little bit of light. And then slowly bring your hands down by the sides of your face, maybe on the outer edge of your arms. Give yourself a little squeeze as you slowly come back into the place that you are. So allowing your eyes to open. Claudia, how did that feel?
So calming. Thank you, Tatum. Yeah, it was, I think when you're speaking so much and you're about the body, weirdly, but you're all in your head, and then it's, you know, bringing you back to your own body and just slowing everything down, and also noticing those connections between different parts of the body, like your breathing and even the sort of coolness or heat that's within your body as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, thank you. That was lovely.
There's so much to explore. I'm so bad with names, but I once heard a geographer talking. He was interviewed, and they asked him, you know, where's next? You've been everywhere in the world, been to every country of the world. Like, where's next? And he said, oh, I do have a project. It's going to take about 2 years. And he said, I want to study my own geography.
Mm.
I want to go and study my internal landscape.
That's fantastic.
And actually, that does take time because there's so much going on. I mean, our bodies are fascinating places full of fascinating random facts. So if you have a random fascinating fact, do let us know. I always love to collect those.
No, I love the ones you were sharing before. I think the pupils changing is a good fact. Also, I think with that one, so if you show people two pictures of the same person, the same face, exactly the same photo, the only difference is that in one of them the pupils are slightly smaller than the other, so they've been sort of manipulated to look like that. And you ask someone, what's the difference between the photos? And they say, oh, there isn't a difference. But you say, which one looks sadder? And they immediately point to the one that has smaller pupils. There's something about us really intuitively understanding emotion through our physical bodies and through that connection. So that, I like that as a little factoid to end on.
Absolutely. And what that also does is, as we're able to connect with ourselves, that's the first step sometimes to connecting with other people around us as well.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Claudia, for
being
here.
Thank you, Tatum. Thank you for having me.
You've given me so much to think about.
Oh, you too, definitely.
We will have to put some of those links in the show notes as well, so do check those
Absolutely.
Out. Thank you to the always awesome Radio Facilities for sponsoring our podcast, and thank you so much to you for listening. It really means such a lot to us that you're here, and it means even more if you wouldn't mind subscribing or leaving us a review or sending us to someone else that you think might enjoy this podcast. It really does help other people to find us. So till next time, bye.
Bye.
Not Your Grandma's Cancer Show.